So I'm delighted to be chairing this particular panel, which really brings together another set of high-profile scholars and practitioners whose work has really been foundational in bringing together life writing and celebrity studies. So this particular panel is focusing on a broad range of life writing genres, including celebrity biography, memoir, journalism, drama. And the three papers will explore the performative aspects and the cultural values at work in the creation, representation and consumption of female celebrity identities, whether they are actresses, pop stars or general cultural icons. So our first speaker is Mary Luckhurst, I mean, who's really one of my own celebrity studies heroines. So it's her 2005 co-edited book on theatre and celebrity in Britain. That was really one of the first books that I turned to when I started looking at celebrity from a historical perspective. She's Professor of Artistic Research and Creative Practice at the University of Melbourne, and we're really lucky to have her here today. She's currently Torch Women in the Humanities Visiting Professor. Her CV just reads enormously impressive. It really kind of ticks all the boxes. She's not only a renowned theatre historian and theatre scholar, but she's also very much a practitioner. She's a playwright, she's a director, she's a translator, she's a pioneer of practice as research. She's a specialist in modern drama, and her most recent books include a critical study of Carol Churchill and also co-edited books on theatre and ghosts, materiality, performance and modernity, and theatre and human rights after 1945. And her work is very much kind of positioned at the intersections of theatre studies and life writing. She's also co-edited volumes, interview collections that are entitled On Directing and On Acting. And her current project is concerned with the staging and performance of real lives and how the factor of female celebrities actually figuring in these processes is, I think, something that she will explore in today's paper, which is entitled Staging Lives, Celebrity Actresses Playing Real Life Celebrities.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I must get you to introduce me more often. thank you for being here. I'm coming from a very different angle to the papers so far. And I think there's just one note before I go into the paper. I very much took Stella's point. A lot of my work, having spent 10 years at the beginning of my career working in theatre, is about making visible the work of actors, directors, and playwrights. And that's a terribly obvious thing to say, but it's still not obvious in theatre studies in my discipline. And so with this subject of celebrity actresses, you'll find that I quote a lot of actors and that I quote directors, and that's quite deliberate because generally those voices are erased, and generally theatre theorists have argued that primary makers say very little about their work, or that material can't be found. That isn't true. And I guess, you know, that's why I've done three interview books. Actors, directors, writers absolutely do want to talk about their process. There's no question. And I'll launch into this with no further ado. Playing a real person is a high-risk business, as many actors have noted. It involves complicated boundary crossings and multiple negotiations between persona and role. In the last two decades, the Oscars, BAFTA, and Logie Awards have set an even higher value on actors who play real people, often connecting the playing of these roles with constructions of virtue and heroism in relation to what the actor supposedly suffers and the emotional stamina required to play the part. Stars have used that cultural value to great effect, and certain actresses have been very strategic in their choices. Why, you might ask, is it perceived as more virtuosic to play a real person in our times? It isn't just about our obsession with reality and celebrity culture, and it certainly isn't because actors necessarily want to vaunt their impersonation skills. Indeed, they commonly disavow them because of the myth that impersonation is only about externals. Impersonation is accorded a less heroic kudos than sustained inhabitation of a role, but has a distinct cultural value all its own, as Alec Baldwin's and Melissa McCarthy's respective lampooning of Donald Trump and Sean Spicer made clear. Impersonation has often been firmly assigned to the role of the comedian, the implication being that comedy is a lower art form, a prejudice that tracks back at least to Shakespeare's day and is embedded in the history of censorship and acts of sedition. The actor's body is the instrument of their art, and the process of embodiment involves much research, experimentation, selectivity, discipline, and practice, and much of this is done in private. We fetishize rehearsal just as much as we can imagine the lack of it, and we rarely think of the weeks and months, sometimes years, an actor can spend alone working on a role. But how far do you go in changing your physique, your face, your hair, your voice? What aspects of the person do you select? Screen generally demands more realism, for example. What material do you work from? What material can you find? Documentary film footage, for example, might show a public persona, but actresses also have to contend with portraying private realms. Can biographers be trusted? Are memoirs, letters, photographs any more reliable? The actress goes on her journey and works from her preference. Find the walk and you'll find the character, some would say. Others need the voice or the clothes or a gesture or stance, the movement of the hands or the tilt of the chin, the enactment of daily tasks or the relationality to loved ones or the passion that drives, the grief that breaks or the trauma that chokes and cripples. For others, it is the seemingly slight detail that provides the critical insight into a psychology and the revelation about how to embody. When Eileen Atkins played Elizabeth I, her insight into playing her monarchical power came with the witness descriptions she read in biographies and the testimonies describing Elizabeth I as seeming to glide through court as though she transcended the court officials around her. Atkins drew on these testimonies and on costume research to perfect a way of moving and behaving that underlined an authority built on constructs of the feminine that mask aggression. In the case of a celebrity actor playing a celebrity, we're talking about the conflation of two personas in the creation of a role in a way that permits the two personas to remain visible in varying chemical concoctions. We watch Atkins give an interpretation of Elizabeth I, and that duality is voyeuristic. We enjoy the double spectacle, we enjoy the tightrope walk, and we hope that she won't stumble. Audiences can measure Atkins' interpretation and own star quality against what they know of the person being represented. Quantifying devices do exist when playing a real person in a way that they don't necessarily for a fictional figure. And we all have examples of an actor who's fallen on their face because they've failed in their attempt to create a convincing portrayal. When I interviewed well-known actors on playing real people for my volume, Playing for Real, I was struck that actors often have a sense of doubleness regarding their stage presence. They both do and don't believe that they've achieved a likeness to their subject. They both do and do not believe that they captured what they refer to as a distillation or a spirit or an essence. They are often seized with the anxiety of looking nothing like their subject and rely on what the actor Henry Goodman has inventively called icon memory, a collective cultural imagining of what a person must have looked or sounded like and the ways they might have behaved. Marlon Brando wrote that an actor's art is to manipulate human suggestibility. This is undoubtedly true, but actors feel a very particular sort of responsibility towards a real subject, and it induces what I've referred to in another essay as an ethical stress and certain measures of self-censorship. Actors agree that playing a real person requires a different kind of preparation and thought process from performing a fictional character. The parameters of playing a real person are different from fictional parameters. As Oliver Ford Davis has said, King Lear can be a tough old bull who should never have abdicated, or a frail man in the early stages of dementia. The text would support both readings. But play Margaret Thatcher, and the choices are more limited. The actors and audiences know a great deal more about her. Sean Phillips, who famously reinterpreted Marlene Dietrich's cabaret persona, argues that with a real person, you have to try and avoid letting too much of yourself seep in. You can bend a fictional character to yourself much more, but you can't do that with a real person. Summoning an impression of a real person is a collective art and relies on a curious concoction of belief and non-belief in actor and spectator, especially in the theatre, where the co-creation of a role between actor and audience is much more imaginatively active. Actresses argue that the more historically remote the person, the lower the risk of alienating spectators. The more images and vocal imprints that have been circulated close to the time of production, the greater the necessity to pay close attention to external details. When you're playing real people who've died recently, or who are still alive, it's a tremendous challenge, argues Sean Phillips. It's a ghastly responsibility because of family and descendants. You can't take liberties, states Kate Blanchett, who has described the incredible responsibility when playing the murdered Irish journalist Veronica Guerin. Blanchett had met Guerin's family, witnessed their grief at first hand, and absorbed the toll of her death. I wanted to do a perfect creative rendition for the family, she said, and at the same time I understood that it was impossible. It was a towering conflict, but one that was at least creatively useful. If you get it right, there's much to be gained from playing icons. Which parts have global currency for celebrity actresses? I'd suggest monarchs, especially Elizabeth I and Elizabeth II. Queen Victoria, politicians, think Margaret Thatcher and Eva Peron. Iconic performers such as Marlene Dietrich and Marilyn Monroe. And the literary giant, Virginia Woolf. To some extent, these figures have become the equivalent of classical roles for celebrity actresses, the chance to assume kinds of authority that Shakespeare's female roles are denied. They are the sort of roles that older actresses have long argued that contemporary playwrights and screenwriters don't necessarily furnish them with enough. The celebrity actress's status only increases by the double performance of power and by the associations of fame with the actress's own brand, and can be deployed greatly to her advantage. How will the actress's skills be tested? How will she rise to the challenge? And how will she distinguish her portrayal? Actresses Dame Eileen Atkins, Dame Helen Mirren, Dame Sean Phillips and Dame Judi Dench are among the royalty of British actresses, and Kate Blanchett, who is artistic director of the Sydney Theatre Company, is Australian royalty. Atkins, Dench, Mirren and Blanchett have famously played Queen Elizabeth I, and Mirren, both Elizabeth I and Elizabeth II. Monarchs perform power, and the performance of authority is a craft which complements the power an actor needs to exert through their acting craft. And each of these actresses is known for the exquisite quality of their performances. That is their brand. For Blanchett, Kapoor's film Elizabeth transformed her into Hollywood royalty and was the launchpad for her international stardom. A second chance to play a mature Elizabeth I in Kapoor's The Golden Age gave her a place in the pantheon of esteemed actresses and elevated her market stock further. The choice of Blanchett, an Australian, to play the role was in itself a testament to the quality of her acting and her global screen potential, and played on the fact that Australia is not yet a republic and still acknowledges the British Queen as monarch. Only in the latter part of her reign has there been a more relaxed attitude to live representation of Elizabeth II on stage. Frere's film The Queen depicted Elizabeth II in the aftermath of Diana's death, which led to a re-examination of the royal household's communication with the media and a redefinition of its relations with the public. Actresses often like to meet the subjects they're going to play, and Mirren has spoken of her tea at Buckingham Palace with the Queen as an important opportunity to get a sense of the person before playing her. It also became a media event in itself. From watching extensive footage, Mirren began to become interested in minute behavioural details, such as how the Queen holds her handbag, puts on her glasses, the differences between her interactions with different people and with her dogs and horses, the subtle clues to different emotional states. Mirren won critical acclaim and became the acknowledged expert in playing Elizabeth II when she won Olivier and Tony Awards for her stage portrayals in London and New York. Elizabeth II's and Mirren's mutual admiration for one another's playing of a role has become somewhat fetishised, and their meeting at a Buckingham Palace party in 2014 provided nuanced performances by both women. Prince William's reference to Mirren as Granny during the evening delighted in blurring the boundaries between fiction and reality, and who might have the greater fame. Mirren's statements about the meeting suggest a relish in the presumptuousness of interpreting the Queen. "I feel like saying I'm sorry and I promise I'll stop," said Mirren. Mirren's own republicanism has not been aired in public since she played Elizabeth, and journalists frequently ask her to speak as though she's privileged insight into the Queen. Mirren's difficulty with the role emerged in an interview when she was asked to talk about weeping in the wardrobe department on Frere's film. "I felt that I couldn't possibly play anyone who'd wear those unfortunate clothes," said Mirren. Individual actors each have their own strategies for finding the physical and mental habitus of their characters, and Mirren's acting persona is one which famously exudes a steamy and mysterious sexuality, carefully crafted through particular costuming. But her comments about her approach seem to suggest that she censored her usual codes of sexual expressiveness when playing the monarch. Mirren's research allowed her to invent a rationale for herself and find a state of mind which was non-judgmental. But her own acting rationale in relation to her role of the Queen was frequently taken as factual insight by journalists. And this confusion, I'd argue, only augmented Mirren's celebrity royalty. Some other pictures of her. Mirren played with that confusion to her advantage and with the illusion of her intimacy with the Queen by asserting that the Queen has been in my life longer than any other person apart from my elder sister. "The Queen," Mirren pronounced in interview, "is completely uninterested in clothes. She's not at all vain. It's like a policeman wearing a uniform. She's wearing her uniform. Forget what the clothes look like. It's what they feel like. And they're made out of unbelievably beautiful fabrics and then lined with incredibly expensive silk. So you put them on and they feel incredible." Mirren had found a strategic way to inhabit the role while wearing clothes that she herself found life-denying. "I think the Queen was always happiest in jumpers," said Mirren, "and now she's happiest in her walking shoes and her kilt and her crop and barber." This image is a modern cliche of the English aristocracy and hints at more than a little caricatured symbolism. In fact, Mirren's own relation to aristocracy is decidedly conflicted. Her paternal grandmother was a member of the Russian aristocracy, Countess Kamensky, who married out of aristocracy. Her father, Pyotr Mironov, came from the upper echelons of the military Russian classes, was rendered without land and money during the Russian Revolution, emigrated, and married a working-class London East Ender. Mirren's childhood was strongly anti-monarchist, and of course immigrant families frequently erase their origins and necessarily reinvent themselves. Countess Kamensky, interestingly, is present in biographies, but absent from Mirren's website. Integral to Mirren's and Dench's acting credentials is their history as leading actresses at the Royal Shakespeare Company in an era where it had status and a direction that it now struggles with. Equally, they are an important part of the London National Theatre's history. They were established as classical theatre actors before moving to the screen, though Dench's move was much later in life. Dench's extraordinary career and her queenly status as a national treasure are as much under examination in her filmic portrayals as Victoria and the Heights of Empire. Her performance of bone-weary duty, aging, and resistance are remarkably nuanced in her renditions of Victoria. Dench's fame is frequently compared to the celebrity of a monarch, and the implication is often that she has equal status, and this has increasingly been the case since Shakespeare in Love. Billy Connolly has reflected that her dameship manages the impossible most days, where she takes on the appearance of a delightful petite woman and a giant of British theatre, and would seem to be the most popular person in the British Isles and possibly the entire empire since the death of the late Queen Mother. In photographs of Dench and the Queen, one cannot help looking at them as women of equal status. I think I have a... There we are. I think that's a great photo. Very interesting image. Dench has assiduously cultivated narratives about her acting craft, which elevate her instinct and intuition. And this cultivation has attracted some wrong-headed beliefs about her hard work and discipline. Her instinct is, of course, highly informed and comes from rigorous discipline and a lifetime of acting experience. Like many actresses, she's intensely private about her preparation. As Sian Phillips has noted, I've worked with a lot of wonderful actresses, but I think Judy has the most acute actor's intelligence. In the way a footballer thinks with his feet, Judy thinks with her acting ability. She says she's not a technical actress, but in fact her technique is impeccable. Director Richard Eyre concurs. Judy has technique to burn, he says. She can turn a line on a fragment of a syllable, a scene on the twist of a finger, which is very much in evidence in Mrs. Brown. But, says Eyre, her technique never shows. She has the ear of a musician and the eye of a painter. All actors have to master the appearance of spontaneity while monitoring their performance with a critical and detached eye. It's this facility for being completely aware and yet appearing totally unself-conscious and innocently spontaneous that Dench has mastered and what is meant by her genius. But she also has a shrewd business head, something that is generally not part of the average narrative of the actress's memoir or biography. And she's selected her real people roles across a spectrum of classes and political hierarchies, both to keep flexing her skills and also to demonstrate her versatility. Versatility is another subject entirely, but in the West, it has become a vital part of celebrity actresses' personae. You have to be able to move across different mediums, as Mirren, Maggie Gale, Meryl Streep, Sian Phillips, Anna de Vere Smith, and a host of others demonstrate. Thank you.
Well, thanks so much, Mary, for giving us this fascinating insight into the strategies employed by actors in the creation of their dual celebrity identities, which I think also raises some poignant questions about, as you also stressed, about the ethics that are involved in these processes. And this is not a very subtle plug here, so for all those of you who are interested in hearing more about this, do come back to Wolfson on the 14th of November when Mary is going to give a lunchtime lecture on the ethics of staging real lives. So I think there's much more interesting and much more exciting stuff that will be coming up here as part of this lecture. Right, but now it's great to be joined here by a lovely colleague and friend, Oline Eaton, with whom Ruth and I were very lucky to collaborate as part of the After Image conference that she co-organised together with Nanette O'Brien in 2015, which really sort of kick-started the life writing and celebrity research strand here at OCLU. And Oline is a scholar who's based at the Centre for Life Writing Research at King's College London, where together with Nanette O'Brien, she ran the Life Writers of London seminar series. She's also a brilliant blogger, if you're not following her hugely entertaining pieces on her blog, Finding Jackie, on celebrity, biography, and feminism. You're really missing out on something. Hugely recommended. As is her feminist podcast, The Way Up, which she only launched this year. On top of everything else, she is a biographer, so An Alarming Life. Her book on Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis is forthcoming, and I guess we're going to be given a sneak preview into that work. Very exciting. And so this is her paper today. I mean, the title is fantastic. It's bound to draw the crowds in any conference. It's God Bless Jackie, the only thing that can make us forget the bomb. So welcome.
Hi, Joanne. So I want to begin by acknowledging that my title is somewhat disingenuous. I picked it some months ago when I didn't know what I wanted to talk about, and with the thought that talking about Jackie always, in some ways, comes back to the bomb. So it's a quote from Anita Loos, the author of such canonical texts as Gentlemen Prefer Blondes and The Women. And she said this on the occasion of Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis' 40th birthday in a feature in a fashion trade paper. She was quoted as saying, God bless Jackie, the only thing that can make us forget the bomb. So that's the one at the top. These are some newspaper clippings that show Jackie by the bomb. So it's a statement that she, I've always assumed, probably gave in jest, but one which cuts to a very important point about celebrity that I use the life of Jackie Onassis to explore. For my dissertation, I produced a draft of a work of creative nonfiction entitled An Alarming Life, in which I examined the American former First Lady's life, but also the construction of her story, its flow through mid-20th century American culture, and the American emotional investment in it. My work is concerned with the links between life narratives and culture, either as a palliative or as a way of working through the anxieties of a given moment, so that writing about the story of Jackie's life can be a way into such varied topics as the Vietnam War and Watergate, the economy, changing attitudes towards divorce, and anxieties about the atomic bomb. Today, though, I'm not actually going to talk about the bomb, though, and I will deviously leave this thought with you, perhaps with Jackie, a Cold War celebrity, we are always in some ways talking about the bomb. Today, I want to tell a story as a way of thinking about biographical evidence when we write about women's lives, particularly celebrities, and the complexity of the stories that we seek to tell, stories which have often been radically oversimplified. The story I'm going to tell today is about shopping. So, Jackie's shopping, biographical depictions of her shopping, newspaper portrayals of it, and the testing of evidence in biography. I chose shopping because in Jackie's story, a story of many convolutions, shopping is a theme that is convoluted in uniquely challenging and deeply bizarre ways, all of which illuminate the tensions between biography and gossip and the complications of testimony. So Jackie, and I'm calling her Jackie here for simplicity's sake, even though it is hugely problematic, she enjoyed shopping, I think more as an artist, because she had this acute sensitivity to aesthetic flaw, and I think she enjoyed putting outfits together for that. She seemed to derive pleasure from the experience of going out and buying, and also of working to develop the goods that she bought so that they would be up to her standards. There is evidence of this in the form of many, many memos to the people who made the things that she often bought. But I'm going to skip that part of it. So during the 1960 presidential campaign, her love of clothes was a recurring theme in the media coverage and also a political problem. There were rumors that she spent a small fortune on French couture. The primary complaint was that it was French couture and it wasn't American. The candidate's wife refuted this by famously telling the New York Times in a page one story, "I couldn't spend that much unless I wore sable underwear." Significantly, during her husband's administration, she was primarily seen as a figure of fashion rather than of conspicuous consumption. So for example, a typical report from March of 1962 in the midst of her solo diplomatic visit to India and Pakistan reads, "Actually, it's not so much what Mrs. Kennedy is buying as the thinking behind it that makes the news. She stands for the whole young movement in fashion. She stands for the Givenchy look and all its interpretations over here as against the fussier French fashions. She stands for colors and for forgetting all the nonsense about definite fashion seasons. She is the most potent force in international fashion today." I would surmise that though the position of First Lady was not and is not typically seen as an actual job in America, because she was in the position of First Lady, she was seen as needing an official wardrobe. So there were details of her wardrobe, but there was far less information on the procurement of it. This changed dramatically with her remarriage to Aristotle Onassis in 1968, when shopping became one of the defining elements of her public image. This was propelled by near daily coverage in the fashion trade publication Women's Wear Daily, which was itemized her outfits to the degree that there was a contemporary joke that it should be renamed What Jackie Wears Daily, and also through a series of articles by this man, the journalist Fred Sparks, which attained a spectacularly wide national reach from 1969 to 1971, and were eventually collected into a book called The $20 Million Honeymoon. And this very misleadingly, his Pulitzer Prize is always mentioned, he won it for his war reporting and not for this. So it's easy to get the impression that Jackie was shopping all of the time. Her outings were described as wild shopping sprees, and she was said to be purchasing armloads of dresses, hats, and handicrafts. Fred Sparks called her the fastest shopper in the West, and he said her face is her credit card. This was such a defining characteristic of her reputation in the early 1970s that in 1973, a Washington matron asked the White House reporter Helen Thomas, "What does Jackie do when the stores close?" But this warrants contextualization. By this point in her fame, over 10 years of unrelenting and escalating press attention, her love of fashion was an established plot point. What happened in the 1970s was that the reports around this were kind of put on steroids, likely in part precisely due to the precarity of the contemporary economic situation. In the midst of a period of recession, with a rising trade deficit, rising unemployment, rising grocery prices, and fuel and meat shortages, the story went from Jackie spends a lot of money to Jackie buys 19 of everything that she buys. The amplification of this narrative is very clearly connected to her remarriage, for diverse reasons, but I will point to two aspects of it that are interesting to me. One is her increased visibility. There are more stories of her shopping precisely because she is seen to be shopping. The paparazzi are essentially surveilling her, and outlets like Women's Wear Daily are reporting on every single thing she bought and all of her outings. Even when she didn't buy anything, it was still a story. The second is that the man she married was Aristotle Onassis. He was vastly wealthy, though precisely to what degree is unknown. But in the early days of their marriage, he actively encouraged her to redecorate his various homes, and he gave her what appears to have been an unlimited allowance, which she used. A crucial aspect within this dynamic, which often goes unnoted as part of the general effort to erase Onassis from the story of her life, is that it benefited his reputation as a wealthy businessman for him to be seen as someone who could keep his wife in such luxury. So in that respect, Jackie's image as a compulsive shopper was good for business. I'm less interested in the reality of how much she spent or what she did or did not buy than I am in the language used in the depictions of her shopping. Our friend Fred Sparks, for example, writes, "In 1969, when Mrs. Onassis, always unannounced, sails into a store, the help, as can be expected, give her more attention than they would anyone else except a hold-up man. If Jackie is really buying madly, the joint when she leaves looks like nothing more less than a battlefield after a firefight with the Viet Cong." Contrast that with the restraint of the photographer Ron Galella's contemporary account, published in his book Jackie in 1974, after she had sued him. Galella wrote, "Jackie loves to shop as much as any woman, maybe more." Significantly, however, he notes, "She didn't demand any special attention or get mad when other customers looked over her shoulder to see what she was buying. She looked at different pairs of shoes, and then she asked, like any other woman would have, if she could try on a pair." This is a portrayal from a source who was not always sympathetic. They had a prolonged legal fight, but he did see her in real life. And it's an account which sits uneasily with the coexisting accounts of her mania and binges, a narrative in which Sparks was heavily invested, since he had an entire book devoted to the subject, and unfortunately, the latter is what seeped into the posthumous biographical accounts. Of those, I want to look in particular at Christopher Anderson's Jackie After Jack, Portrait of a Lady, and Edward Klein's Just Jackie, Her Private Years, both from 1998. For those who haven't read these, and if you have, I would love to talk to you, Anderson's is a fairly straightforward clip job of just random stuff from newspapers and interviews, while Klein's is ridiculously interesting because it is structured as a series of short theatrical vignettes, which have enough invented dialogue that it could easily transition to the stage. But they're an illuminating pairing in regards to the subject of shopping and the bizarre internecine battle occurring between them on this theme. Anderson writes in Jackie After Jack that she was, quote, a compulsive, manic consumer for whom the term shopaholic might have been invented. And her out-of-control spending would ultimately play a major role in destroying her marriage to Onassis. There may be some truth to this claim, as we'll get to, but he goes on, Jackie splurged shamelessly, he writes, noting Onassis insider Costa Grazos accurately described her as a speed shopper, and claiming that by 1972, the marriage was well on the way to unraveling over Jackie's spending. But Anderson's only source regarding her spending are a store manager at an unnamed Fifth Avenue shop, and Costa Grazos, who was an employee of Aristotle Onassis. If we move over to Just Jackie, Anderson's reliance on Grazos for evidence is quickly complicated. Through testimony from Helene Arpel, the wife of the proprietor of Van Cleef & Arpel, and a woman who'd known Jackie since the 1950s, Klein undermines Grazos' reliability. According to Arpel, she was not a compulsive shopper, she was not extravagant, not at all like the acquisitive monster portrayed in the press. Many of those stories about her spending came from Costa Grazos. Notably, Anderson doubled down on his version of events in 2003's Sweet Caroline, his book about Jackie's daughter, Caroline Kennedy, where he calls Jackie mommy the entire time. But in that book, we're reminded that Jackie's spendthrift ways had pushed Jack to the brink, and we're told of how Caroline watched her mother and Ari argue bitterly over her compulsive spending. In that count, Grazos is gone, and his testimony is replaced by that of Roy Kahn, with no mention made of the fact that Kahn, who's now more famous as Donald J. Trump's mentor, had a well-known vendetta against the Kennedys running back to the 1950s, and that, like Grazos, he had fed anti-Jackie stories to the contemporary press. Both Grazos and Kahn help Anderson tell the story he wants to tell, and he uses them indiscriminately without acknowledging their biases. As a result, the story these two sources were leaking to the contemporary press is perpetuated, resituated as a biographical fact. Jackie is simply a compulsive shopper, a common, overly simplistic, often sexist trope in depictions of women as consumers. So that seems rather straightforward. A woman liked to shop and some men pathologized her shopping. But why? And to what ends? By 1973-ish, Jackie's marriage to Aristotle Onassis had deteriorated, in large part due to his son's death that January and what appears to have been something of a nervous breakdown, coupled with his own health troubles and the myasthenia gravis that would eventually kill him in March of 1975. This was an enormously complicated situation, but it seems to have manifested in a simultaneous longing for his wife to be more attentive and an absolute hatred of her when she was near. He also seems to have experienced extreme paranoia, which played out in some incredibly shady ways. In December of 1974, according to Klein, and apparently at Costa Grazos' suggestion, Onassis summoned the columnist Jack Anderson. In his column that December, Jack Anderson reported that at this meeting, Onassis discussed the economy, oil, the CIA, Watergate, and his wife, and he scoffed at reports of a divorce. However, in May of 1975, 2 months after Onassis's death, Jack Anderson published another column. Her favorite insignia is the dollar sign, Jack Anderson wrote. She is so avaricious, so greedy, he reported a close friend of the Onassis's saying, who, based on speech pattern, sounds like Costa Grazos. And he told of how Jackie had resold her clothes for cash. It was a monetary monomaniac, he calls her, a woman who, quote, raised pin money to the level of a six-figure tax shelter and turned her clothing into a resale industry. In response to this column, Jack Anderson received what he called a Vesuvius of angry denials and denunciations, so intense that he wrote a follow-up column establishing Aristotle Onassis as his primary source. Titled, Jackie, She Lived a, Chose a Life of Uselessness, this article criticized the former First Lady for shirking her responsibility and pursuing a life of luxury, languor, gowns, jewels, and the wheedling of unearned wealth. What the article also established is that her husband had fed a reporter details of her spending at a time when his death appeared imminent, so that they might be reported later at a time when she would be likely to be challenging the provisions of his will. So that's diabolical, but it is not this story's end. A key component of Jack Anderson's indictment of Jackie in his April column was the accusation that she systematically converted gowns, gifts, and other indulgences of Onassis into cash by selling them off at fashionable New York City resale houses. This was, in fact, very old news, so there's an air of exoticism to these accounts, the sense of men making hay out of something that was a typical part of women's lives. There are not a lot of newspaper articles that I could find analyzing the state of clothes consignment industry, but there are a lot of adverts and some mentions. This one in particular is from 1974 and basically says, stop, we can't do consignment anymore, we've had too much stuff, which would suggest that a lot of women were doing this and that this was a frequently used way of getting cash. So in the early 1970s, many women had no credit history because their credit card accounts were in their husbands' names. American women could not apply for credit without a male cosigner until the passage of the Equal Opportunity Credit Act of 1974, which went in effect in June of 1976. So closed consignment was a way of earning quick cash. Thanks to a syndicated 1967 article on Florence Berry's Encore, that shop in New York City was one of the most famous in the country, and Jackie sold there. This was standard practice for well-to-do New York women who had limited access to money outside of the store-based charge accounts and whose husbands expected them to be seen in new outfits, lest a repeat make it look like business was down. In Jackie's case, there's evidence to suggest that the problem of repeating outfits was not her primary motivation. She regularly re-wore clothes, much to the consternation of the photographers whose pictures went for far less as a result. So it seems like she resold precisely because she wanted or needed the cash. That is not a reality ever conveyed in the contemporary press accounts of her shopping, and when they discuss her reselling, the biographies by and large repeat Jack Anderson's claims, thus repeating Aristotle Onassis' account that she was essentially laundering his money and stockpiling it. I want to conclude this story of Jackie's shopping with a final piece of evidence. Evidence from a woman, for we have predominantly heard from men up to here, which I personally like because it fits with my own idea of Jackie as someone who was fiercely independent and creative and who, when she wanted to, would move heaven and earth to get something done for a friend. Gloria Emerson was the New York Times' war reporter in Saigon, who had known Jackie since sometime in the early 1950s. They admired one another a great deal. When Jackie was interviewed by Gloria Steinem for Ms. Magazine in 1978, she said, "If I hadn't married, I might have had a life very much like Gloria Emerson's." In 1996, 2 years after Jackie's death, Emerson offered a provocative twist on the story of Jackie's shopping in an interview with the historian and biographer Carl Sferrazza Anthony, who subsequently published this account on his blog. I've still not been able to corroborate the details as evidence of Emerson's work is proving really difficult to locate. However, it was likely around 1973 or 1974 that Emerson was opening a clinic in Vietnam intended to treat children maimed in the war. According to Emerson, when Jackie asked Onassis to donate to the hospital, he not only refused but disparaged the effort. At this time, Onassis had already curtailed his wife's discretionary funds and was monitoring her spending closely, but her store credit accounts were still active. She could spend within the store, and then the bills would be submitted to her husband to pay. According to the biographer C. David Heyman, whose work is often horrible and should be taken with a cartload of salt, but who seems reliable to me in this case paradoxically for the precise reason that his source for this story is the aforementioned unreliable Costa Grazos, Onassis at some point late in their marriage received a bill from a Parisian fashion house for a collection of couture gowns that he'd never seen his wife wear. He exclaimed to Grazos, "What the hell does she do with all of the clothes that she buys?" As Emerson told Anthony, Jackie made a sizable donation to help her hospital, a donation that was received in cash. I don't mean to suggest here that this was always the case and that all of her shopping had to do with philanthropy. I don't think it did. But I do want to suggest a need to complexify our views of such stories and of our having an awareness of the ways in which sexism pervades evidence as well as biographical writing and interpretations. Thanks.
Thanks so much for this great talk. And it seems to me what this also highlights is, I mean, how the representation of women's lives in popular biographical writing is very much highlights, or is very much caught up, I mean, in this age-old debate that sort of separates celebrity from, like, achievement, merit, talent. Yeah, I mean, all these things that seem to form the basis of true and deserved fame. And it ties up, I think, very nicely with this issue of cultural value that is going to be explored in our next paper in connection with the celebrity memoir. And I mean, really, I could not be more delighted to see Hannah Yellen here today. It was not sure at all whether she'd be able to make it. I mean, and as you can see, she's got the best and the loveliest excuse ever. Her four-week-old son, Arvo, who's absolutely adorable and who's sleeping soundly. let's see for how long. But let me introduce her to you very briefly. Hannah is a lecturer in media and culture at Oxford Brookes University, and her work is situated at the intersections of life writing, celebrity, and gender politics. And she's currently completing her first monograph, which is going to be entitled Subjectivity for Sale, The Gender Politics of Ghosted Celebrity Memoir, which explores the implications of ghostwriting for the way in which we understand the gendered parameters of authenticity, authorship, and agency. Again, it's a very timely topic, and if you want to find out more about it, come back to Wolfson next week on Tuesday, where there's going to be a panel on ghostwriting, actually. So she's really sort of onto the important topics in relation to celebrity studies. She's also running a series of events under the title of Celebrity Culture Club.
That's right.
Which brings together academics and people from the media industries to discuss some of the most pressing questions about celebrity culture today. And so, yes, her talk today is concerned with agency, with authorship, particularly the authorship and agency in relation to the female pop star image. And so her talk today is entitled Celebrity Performativity and Cultural Value, Reading Grace Jones's I'll Never Write My Memoirs. So please make her feel very, very welcome. It's absolutely wonderful to have you.
Thank you. Thank you, Sandra, for such a lovely introduction and for facilitating us being here. I'm amazed that we've made it. And Arvo's very happy to be here on his 1 month birthday. So, as Sandra says, we'll together be discussing Grace Jones's ironically titled memoir called I'll Never Write My Memoirs. Now, the celebrity memoir traditionally, as I'm sure has been discussed much today, is considered to occupy a nexus of access and authenticity, combining, as it does, the intimate revelations that are central to celebrity culture with autobiography's promise of self-disclosure of a personal truth. So, as such, their respective scholarly fields have been much concerned with theorising and problematising such claims to authenticity. This paper, however, examines Jones's 2015 memoir as an example which contravenes the structuring tendency in both celebrity culture and autobiography to claim to offer up access to an authentic self or show the real woman behind the public image. So in this paper, I shall use Jones's autobiographical self-presentation to put forward the idea of doing celebrity, whereby celebrity and pop stardom are presented as a deliberately constructed set of actions or behaviours rather than an ontology. So celebrity is something that one does rather than something that one is. Moreover, we shall see that Jones's embrace of performativity over authenticity is something that is situated as being part of a wider art practice, a move which makes claim to the status of creative agent and the author of the star image. So we see her seeking a level of cultural value otherwise often denied to the figure of the female pop star celebrity. Let's start with a fantastic, fantastically surreal scene. There's her memoir, by the way, that she narrates in her memoir of being photographed by the paparazzi whilst out jogging with the famous artist Andy Warhol. By contrast to celebrities who commonly discuss the paparazzi in terms of violation, Jones says, "I try to put on a little show for them. After all, we were once photographed jogging in Central Park, him in jeans and jacket, me in little Batty Rider shorts. That was a performance. I am aware of the fact that what is being photographed is the fantasy of fame. And for that moment, that is what I am representing. At that moment, I am the centre of fame." So this quote is both an admission of courting celebrity and a knowing claim of being in on the joke of celebrity culture's performative nature. It takes the media's efforts to capture what Richard Dyer calls the off-screen, that is the space supposedly offering a glimpse of a more real star, and makes no such claim to authenticity. Rather, her memoir demonstrates a self-reflexive awareness of celebrity as a, quote, as she says in her quote there, a little show, which she both courts and constructs in apparently candid moments, supposedly captured by paparazzi. However unlikely the company and attire. This moment of contrived celebrity she calls a performance and a fantasy, what she is representing rather than what or who she is. A key difference between this framing and the more common framing of a true self revealed is a claim to agency in the construction of the star image. Unlike the usual discourses of paparazzi intrusion or violation, this is a little show that she chooses to construct. On the one hand, Jones's performative jogging with Warhol suggests that celebrity status is something to be actively cultivated. This is what Olivier Dressian's terms celebrity capital. Accumulated media visibility which can be converted into other resources such as economic or political capital. However, on the other hand, Jones's emphasis upon fabrication, in this we can see also a distancing from or undermining of perhaps a little distaste for celebrity. Consistently in her memoir, we see Jones seeking to position herself in cultural fields beyond that of celebrity. Thus, at the same time, celebrity becomes a label to be avoided lest it diminishes a star's access to cultural value. This problematization of the concept of celebrity capital would accord more with P. David Marshall's account of celebrity, in which it is surrounded by, quote, an air of inauthenticity and a vulgar sense of notoriety. Viewing this question through the lens of gender, as Christine Geraghty does, offers further consideration of why, despite being a form of tradable capital, female celebrities may wish to distance themselves from the cultural field of celebrity. Geraghty argues for the intrinsically gendered nature of the concept of celebrity, given that women are particularly likely to be seen as celebrities whose working life is of less interest than their personal life. Thus, while celebrity can be seen to be accumulated and traded for certain forms of capital, celebrity can just as easily be cast as a toxic constituent that damages, in particular, female stars' cultural value through a delegitimizing emphasis upon the vulgar notoriety of their private lives at the expense of attention upon their creative and cultural work. And here's some of Jones's iconic creative and cultural work. Thus, in Jones's memoir, we see an ambivalence towards celebrity status and a desire to recenter her cultural work. Writing a memoir is necessarily an act of self-canonization, extending, reinforcing, and reframing and capitalizing upon one's existing celebrity status. Yet, at the same time, Jones clearly does not wish to be received as merely a celebrity or even as a pop star, and seeks at points to distance herself from the phenomenon. Of the Studio 54 milieu, Jones speaks disparagingly of those seeking to increase or maintain their celebrity status. Quote, Minor celebrities fighting among minor celebrities to avoid losing their fame, demented role-playing, doing whatever it took to get some attention. Here, Jones appears to ascribe to the conservative view of celebrity as bemoaned by Daniel Boorstin 50 years ago for its lack of, quote, greatness, worthy endeavours, or talent, end quote. And it is not just minor celebrities that receive this treatment. Jones's memoir appears similarly to be seeking to distance her from major global stars. Quote, I was refining my stage show so that it would be more exciting and a long way from what Gloria or Donna or Sister Sledge would be doing. I was determined not to perform like other singers. So that's Donna Summer or Gloria, surname's forgotten, but he's kind of... hardcore disco greats, yes, exactly. She also says, I wasn't really a singer or a dancer, a Jagger or a Tina, so I took things in unusual directions. So despite there being respected global institutions of disco, rock and soul, Jones's distinctions about her place in relation to other celebrities or pop stars are not merely acts of distancing, but of elevation above. When Jones claims to take her work in more unusual directions than other established pop stars, she suggests that she is not merely a pop star. Jones performs her superiority through the taste distinctions that she makes when she identifies amongst her peers, quote, a lot of bad taste in the way that female singers were expected to perform, predominantly centering upon bad taste, quote, bad taste in fashion and a tackiness in how pop singers looked. Throughout these accounts, we see at play Bourdieu's theory of distinction and the politics of taste as Jones distinguishes herself through the distinctions that she makes, clearly situating herself in a hierarchy of cultural value in relation to those she judges as falling short. Moreover, Bourdieu's ideas of the cultural field are illuminating when it comes to Jones's apparent desire to be seen to traverse beyond the categories of celebrity or pop star. For Bourdieu, cultural products and producers are located within hierarchical and relational cultural fields. This he constitutes as, quote, a space of positions and position takings in which one's social status is negotiated. Bourdieu's cultural fields are thus made up of possible positions that accord with central cultural values that operate within them. By this account, the star image of Grace Jones will be structured by a particular overlapping set of subfields that constitute the black, female, avant-garde, pop star, celebrity, each with an overlapping set of values which delineate the space of possible positions she can adopt. What is in evidence in her account is a constant negotiation of access to cultural value. For example, Jones elevates her pop music by presenting herself as able to range over and borrow capital from diverse fields and thus create music that is more than, not merely, pop music. What Jones calls, quote, a stylized border crossing, blending reggae, electronics, pop and disco to create new forms of pop in the underground, end quote. This is always described in terms of the multiple fields it traverses. The narration of Jones's life story demonstrates a constant alertness to the intersecting cultural fields over which she ranges, relating key events, places and people specifically in terms of the various cultural fields they represent and the various capitals afforded and negotiated as a result. Paris, for example, is to Jones a, quote, complicated weave of art, frivolity, entertainment, business, sex, illusion, end quote. Implicit is the suggestion that were her activities in Paris all business or all entertainment, they would be of less value, with associated connotations of mercenary coldness or cheap vacuity, respectively. As a rhizomatic assemblage of illusion and art, however, it becomes complicated, to use her word, intriguing, erudite, knowing. Through performance and art, it becomes more than. Jones's self-elevation through the demonstration of an ability to traverse cultural fields is ultimately geared towards the positioning of her pop output as a form of performance art practice. Indeed, the memoir is billed as, quote, a manic coupling of life and art in the reviews in its opening pages, framing the forthcoming action and guiding the reader as to the cultural fields in relation to which it should be understood. Jones, the memoir makes clear, wishes to be considered as an artist, stating, quote, I was as much a performance artist as a pop singer or actress, end quote. Crucially, it is not that she is an artist as well as a pop star. Rather, through traversing multiple cultural fields, she constructs an artistic creation of pop stardom. By doing pop stardom as a wider practice informed by a wide knowledge of high cultural fields, it becomes performance art. Quote, it was as though Marlene Dietrich, Bertolt Brecht and Piet Mondrian were as important an influence on pop as Elvis, as though music could be connected to art and theatre. It was like the invention of a new genre, related to the musical, the opera, to circus, to cinema, to documentary, to the art gallery. Jones situates herself and her work as deserving a place amongst historic creative visionaries of art, theatre and cinema, claiming, as she does so, the cultural value associated with such highbrow cultural forms. Moreover, she is cast as a cultural pioneer, creating new genres through her rhizomatic recombinant approach to the traversability of cultural fields. In accordance with Bourdieu's theorization of cultural fields as fundamentally relational and hierarchical, Jones's casting of her work in the artistic mould is often at the expense of others in the field of pop. She states, quote, I was interested in presenting myself as a singer in a way that broke away from what had very quickly become a very narrow set of traditions. Most pop performance didn't take into account pop art or Warhol's films, a European catwalk or Japanese theatre. End quote. So performing distance from her peers in the field of pop music, she articulates pop music in terms of what it lacks, namely knowledge of higher cultural forms. Instead, readers are asked to view Jones's own work as comparatively, quote, more experimental and almost academic in its pursuit of musical perfection. Jones seeks to access and trade in the cultural and symbolic capital associated with higher cultural forms, situating her work at the intersection of fields that are, as Bourdieu argues, fundamentally relational and comparative. She therefore cannot be seen to be seeking reappraisal or rehabilitation of her existing cultural field in terms of perceived cultural value. Rather, she could be argued to be throwing other pop stars under the bus as she seeks to escape the cultural field of pop stardom in an act of self-elevation through reframing her work as art. When difficulty in her career does arise, it's due to others' inability to recognise her transposition of pop into higher cultural fields. She states of her record label, they misunderstood me. They saw me as representing the world of fashion, still the celebrity model singer, the haywire Studio 54 chanteuse, not someone who was always experimenting with herself and taking responsibility for every detail of her work. It is crucial that the status of creative agent is a highly masculinized position, often denied specifically to female celebrities. What Jones describes as the celebrity model singer, the haywire Studio 54 chanteuse, is a heavily gendered figure, and the associated charges of lack of professionalism and integrity that Jones seeks to distance herself from are equally gendered. Thus, Jones could be seen to be denigrating her fellow women in pop in the process of seeking a higher status for herself. It is significant then that Jones does point out the structural inequalities of the music industry sexism, as she depicts the struggle to be taken seriously as a woman and an artist, reinforcing Geraghty's reading of celebrity as a gendered and as such limiting cultural category. She states, I was not being a prima donna, I was just trying to concentrate on a technically difficult task while I was being talked to like a silly pop singer who'd got carried away with her own ego. I was female. Had I been a man, they would have considered I was merely retaining control or professionally fretting about the details. Reframing pop stardom as art practice is therefore a means of claiming agency as a woman that is not otherwise afforded. Doing pop stardom as an erudite, self-reflexive, knowing performance about fame and celebrity can transform it into art, affording the traditionally masculinized status of creative agent and author of one's own image. Famous pop artist Andy Warhol features heavily in Jones's memoir. At points, this is in anecdotes that underscore Jones's own star power, like the paparazzi jogging scene. Moreover, Warhol is brought in as evidence that Jones's pop stardom was indeed a knowing, self-reflexive performance. Quote, Andy would want me to look and act famous. Warhol is presented as actively amplifying Jones's knowing performativity. Keeping a dictaphone, recording their interactions. Jones reacts to this thus, maybe I exaggerated a little knowing the tape was on, performed more. But then everything I did was like a performance, so I was his ideal subject. Jones is thus transformed from merely being another sincere Studio 54 celebrity, like those who so provoked her ire, to creating a performance about celebrity, as befits the ideal subject and muse for one of the most iconic artists of the 20th century. Through Warhol's approval, Jones can present the commercial aspects of her pop career as culturally validated. Andy would never make you feel guilty about selling yourself, she says. Most pertinently to the interests of this paper, Warhol is repeatedly used to underscore stories that suggest the collapsibility of celebrity and performance art. For example, Warhol's studio, The Factory, is the site of production not only of artworks, but of celebrity. Quote, New York was the centre of the artistic universe, and The Factory was at the centre of the centre, and at the centre of that was Andy. He created stars, end quote. In service of the idea of celebrity as art practice, Jones casts Warhol as star maker for herself and others. When Jones states of Warhol, quote, he saw that this whole celebrity thing was where everything was happening. He was a voyeur and he saw which direction the energy was heading. He saw the art in everything. She adds evidence to her own argument that what she did as a pop star, she did as an artist. If, quote, Andy was obsessed with celebrity and his curiosity about it would infect the whole world, end quote, then through art, Jones's pop stardom can be rehabilitated from the delegitimized, vacuous state that Boorstin, Marshall, and Geraghty identify in the cultural construction of celebrity, and especially female celebrity. Of course, society has long accepted this knowing performance of pop as art from white male creatives, for example, Warhol, or the also frequently mentioned in the memoir, alternative pop star David Bowie, are understood as constructing art about celebrity or pop stardom, with less contestation than female figures such as Jones, her contemporary Madonna, or even more recent female pop artists like Lady Gaga or M.I.A. As white men with a surfeit in symbolic and cultural capital, Bowie and Warhol already have far less disputed access to the role of artist, creative agent, or auteur than Jones as a woman of colour. The comparative weight of her endeavour to be taken seriously is an evidence not least in the production of an entire memoir dedicated to the task of reframing her career as an artistic practice over which she had some control. It's hard to imagine Warhol or Bowie ever having to do the same. To conclude, memoir is, by its very nature, an intervention into the discourses that surround a star. Recognizing this explicitly, Jones's introduction describes the autobiographical occasion prompting the book to be written thus. Quote, there is no better way for me to take control of the stories of my life than to tell them myself in a book, end quote. Between the memoir's pages, a space is created where the meaning of a life's work can be controlled or reframed. The way Jones's memoir seeks to reframe her career in the limelight is as a self-aware, deliberately constructed oeuvre of performance art. A reframing that opens up access to the masculinized status of creative agent and artist so often denied female celebrities. In so doing, Jones elevates herself above the generalized mass of disparaged female celebrity, asking to be considered amongst white male contemporaries whose celebrity goes unchallenged as artistic statement, and whose artistic statements use the concept of celebrity as source material. It is not without problems that Jones's acts of self-elevation are fundamentally individual, not collective. Jones is not looking for a reappraisal of the feminized and therefore unjustly maligned genre, only for herself to be elevated beyond it. In this example, I've put forward the concept of doing celebrity, showing that it is by demonstrating her knowingness about the inherent performativity of celebrity that Jones is able to claim agency beyond that traditionally afforded the female pop star or celebrity. Through doing celebrity, Jones's pop becomes art, and she herself is asserted as a creative agent and artist, traversing but not limited to the cultural field of pop. Thank you.